My name is Jessica Ockberger, and I'm the curator of Africana here at Michigan State University Libraries. We're in the Vincent Voice Library, and I'm here with Justice Albie Sachs, who's going to be speaking through the photographs of the Leonard Fried South Africa Photograph Collection, which is also housed here in our special collections. Thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate it. The first set of photos that we're going to be looking at are the beginning of this photo collection, when Leonard Fried was in South Africa in 1994, when Mandela was campaigning for president.
Well, it's a picture of ANC media people resting. They must have been very tired. The 1994 elections, it's not even once in a lifetime. It's once in the history of a whole country, and they're particularly important in South Africa because we weren't fighting for independence. We didn't want a separate state from Britain or anywhere. South Africa had been formally decolonized in 1910, but only whites got the vote. Now, 1994, everybody gets the vote. So the vote was our independence, and it was one story was told of an old man was brought to the polling station in a wheelbarrow, and he didn't want to die before he voted. So the media must have been absolutely exhausted. And they weren't media who'd been around for years and become cynical and knew all the tricks of the game. They probably didn't even know the word media, most of them. Everything was banned. Restricted. The ANC, to be part of the ANC meant you went to jail, full stop, end of matter. So you couldn't broadcast ANC, you couldn't have, you can see one person here, he's got the symbol of the ANC, the logo of the ANC, you just couldn't have that at all. And now they're so casual and relaxed, it's the total contrast to the underground work, the Mandela and Robben Island, us in exile. So these are the emotions that come through. And I think about that generation now. It's 25 years have gone, and nobody knew what would happen. It was so peaceful. It was so wonderful that day. Black and white standing in a line. That became the day when, if you like, South Africa saw the oath of allegiance to itself. The voting was over 2 days. It was the proof that democracy is for Africa, democracy was for our country. And I think they have a right to be kind of smiling a little bit because they knew it was going well. Enormous support for the ANC. Now we've had some pretty rough, tumultuous moments, and some of these people might be in the media. They might be journalists, communicators, broadcasters. And the media played a huge role in our country. Media going along with the corruption, being used to close down honest, good people through leaked stories. But the media, investigative journalists, doing terrific work that ends up often in the courts, in parliament, in election campaigns inside the ANC. So hats off to the media.
Absolutely. South Africa has a media tradition now that's just so different from anywhere else on the continent. I'm curious if you know why the young women in this photo are wearing uniforms and what those uniforms might mean.
My guess from the color white is that they were part of a religious group. Not the Zionists who were up in the north. Maybe it's a big confession called the Shembe, but I wouldn't know it. It's pure guess on my part.
Okay. What I'm curious about, and this will be true throughout more of these photographs, unfortunately, there isn't as much detail on the back of them as
it says South Africa elections.
All of them say that. That's just the collection name. But I'm curious because they also are holding pieces of paper or banners that say ANC on it. And I'm curious what your reflections are of the role of the churches in this first election.
I couldn't see. You say there is a little sign.
Yeah, so in their pockets right here, you can see where it says the ANC logo.
Okay.
And so this is also true of some later photos in this collection of the Zionist movement.
The Zionist movement itself, so these would be African Zionists, nothing to do with Israel.
Sure.
Didn't take a stand. And they would invite the leaders of the big political parties to attend a rally of about 1 million people north of Johannesburg. And there was intense competition between Mandela, F.W. de Klerk, and Mangosuthu Buthelezi. And they had to sit it out for hours. And it was particularly tough on de Klerk because he's a chain smoker. And he couldn't nip out for a quick smoke. In the case of Mandela, he always said religion is a private matter. And he was very respectful of belief confessions. And he would very comfortably and happily attend a Christian church, go to a mosque, Muslim. The only time in decades that I went to synagogue was when Mandela was there. The mayor of Cape Town invited me to be there, and he was marvelous, the way he spoke to. I mean, I hated the men downstairs, the women upstairs. I felt very awkward, but he just knew how to address everybody. Well, if there were something like drum majorettes, it wouldn't be at the polling stations because that wasn't allowed. You weren't allowed within, 500 yards or something to have demonstrations or regalia. Maybe I can get a clue from one of the other pictures.
Sure. I think most of these are not, as far as I can tell from looking through them, none of these are of actual election day, but sort of the lead up to. So this is a rally.
Yes.
I'm not sure if this is the same one you were just speaking of, because it seems like quite a large group of people. They're all in a stadium.
Yes.
And there are some signs that are being held up. Some are in Afrikaans and some are in English, but there's one in English and it says jobs, jobs, jobs. And I just think that that's really poignant when you think about South Africa today.
Yes, well, it's a, in a way, a very remarkable picture because right in the front it's jobs, 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 and at the top in Afrikaans, stem vir vrouerechte, vote for women's rights, a better life for all. There was a debate as to what the slogan should be, and initially the theme was now is the time, and in the different languages of the country. And Stan Greenberg from the United States, who'd worked with the Democratic Party in the U.S., a great bowling, one of the kind of top people in that area, came to South Africa, and he said that that's very aggressive. It depends what theme you want to convey. Shouldn't you do something that seems less threatening? Now is the time. So a better life for all. I think he proposed that. He writes about this. It might be worth following up. So a better life for all. And the projection of Mandela with children, optimism for the future, seeing an ANC government as a kind of natural transition to a friendly, warm, generous society, rather than ANC on the warpath. Now, that's exactly what many young South Africans today are complaining about. They wished it was, now is the time. But the fact was, at that time, the guns were in the hands of the South African military, white. There were thousands of white soldiers, in the army and in the reserve, waiting for a command. They could have had an insurrection. In the end, they would have been put down, but we wouldn't have had a country. The public administration, the civil service, all the higher levels ranks were in white hands. They could have paralyzed the country, the economy in white hands. So our leadership was very keen that democracy should not be associated with breakdown, corruption, not corruption, destruction, chaos, food shortages, but with a peaceful transition, more dignity, more humanity, and that was the reason for the decision to say a better life for all.
Thank you. We're back to these drum majorettes, but I want to keep going a bit. It's a very similar photo to the one before.
Okay, well, it shows how wrong I am. You see, oh. I said wearing white, they're unlikely to be drum majorettes, and here I can distinctly see. The flags. It's kind of a gracious, non-militaristic and non-pageantry. And maybe the use of white was to make it look sober, like you'd get maybe with a religious group.
Sure. I'm gonna ask you to reflect on this one, because there are several photographs like this where there are clearly people going out to campaign or attend campaign celebrations, and they're loaded up in the back of a truck, as is so common form of a transport throughout Africa. And I just...
You know, what I see from this is why the ANC got such huge support, over 60% of the population, and probably ...70-80% of the African population, and that's after all the maneuvering, the tribal chiefs going this way and that, the people who'd been working for the old regime as police officers and administration. And you see, these are not slick professional electioneering people. These are people from the community who would have been in the struggle, and the struggle resisting the past laws, demanding the vote, fighting for the release of Mandela. Some, their children would join Kontowesizwe, giving safe houses for the military from the ANC, things like that. And now it's the next stage. Now it's using the vote to start dismantling apartheid and creating a better life for all. And I must say, it's something I like about it. They're not wearing uniforms. They're not like people who've been briefed to give a particular message, marching in a kind of formation. There's nothing slick about them at all. And I think many people feel the loss of that sense of authenticity. And in a sense, life has changed. And the world of South Africa has changed quite dramatically since then. But the professionalizing of elections has come at a cost, quite a big cost.
Interestingly, because you just mentioned uniforms, and it appears that there is some sort of uniform that the women in this photo are wearing. It's of a crowd of people.
Yes.
And there are two women in the foreground that, yes, seem to be wearing some sort of ANC regalia that looks almost militaristic.
No, well, that they would have been marshals for the crowds. They actually played a very important role in directing people where to go, where to sit, not to get involved in little conflicts. So the marshals were very important for peace. And
these marshals came from the party itself and not from the police force, or?
So the police would be there, but try and keep in the background. The police had a very ambiguous reputation, mainly seen as hostile enemy on the other side, being rough to the people. And the ANC's claim was, you know, we African people, we don't have to be herded around like cattle or sheep, and we will get our own marshals. When we apply for permission to demonstrate or have a meeting, we'll have our marshals, and they will ensure that the things are orderly. And then this would have been, I don't know if it's a marshal's uniform, ANC marshal's uniform, or the Women's League, ANC Women's League. And you see a lot of women in the crowd, and they mixed in the crowd. You see in some other countries that claim to be quite advanced, you'll see men in front and then the women coming up behind, mm-hmm. or the women coming as partners, you know, accompanying their menfolk. And not so here. And I can see the one, couple of eyes looking at the photographer, I guess. Who is this guy? So this is in English and Afrikaans, and it's a sport complex, so it would be in the Western Cape somewhere, a rural area.
There are many wonderful photos, I feel, of women in these, but I particularly love the look of joy on this woman's face. She seems to me to have
such
hope.
You know
hope.
What this reminds me of, though? It's a friend of mine, a white guy, quite a small guy, who'd been in the struggle since he was like 20, and he was locked up when I was locked up, and then in exile when I was in exile, and we came back more or less at the same time. And he was a key person in the ANC branch in Sea Point. Sea Point's a kind of upmarket white suburb. And he published his autobiography, and on the cover it shows a picture of him being held up on the shoulders of some African men. And it's like they're holding up their comrade and hero. He said, in fact, he'd managed to get this guy a job. And so this guy was so happy, he lifted him up on his shoulders. It had nothing to do with belonging to the branch, but it captured the spirit in the branch. So this woman here, she's clearly very, very happy. But she also knows, you know, there's a camera there. I want them to know I'm happy. And African people, it's a huge generalization, but can be very expressive. If they're mourning, you hear the screaming, the crying. And if you're happy, you come out. And she's waving, yep, yippee. You know, this is our day.
These are just a continuation of... Nope, and now it's no longer a continuation. We're now into some photos of just everyday life in South Africa at the time. So there are some photos of in town. Eventually there are also some photos in townships of just life in South Africa in 1994.
Yes. I look here, and the first thing I notice is a package with Outspan on it. Outspan oranges became the focus of an international boycott of South African goods. They were all over the world, and that was their marketing thing, Outspan. And the posters denouncing apartheid would say, don't eat blood oranges, Outspan oranges. So here now there's an Outspan package underneath there. I'm sure the people selling their fruit with this makeshift umbrella sitting on a kind of a box with a wheelbarrow nearby, had no idea about the international significance of Artspan. And what do you notice? It's messy. There's litter everywhere. It would have been about 1997, Walter Sisulu, one of the great leaders, was given the freedom of Johannesburg City. So at the city hall, there was a big crowd, a very, very popular leader, Walter. When I was taken to Robben Island, the person who took me said, when we were in trouble, who did we go to? Nelson Mandela. When he was in trouble, who did he go to? Walter Sisulu. And now Walter Sisulu was turning 80, I guess. And he'd get the freedom of the city, and the place is packed. And there's an Imbongi comes in, the praise singer, wearing traditional costume, speaking loudly in different African languages, but praising, and I've got somebody next to me translating, praising our great leader who never gave up the spirit of not ever being defeated, leading the people, the nation wisely, the lion of the Bushveld, the elephant of whatever it was, you know, very, very powerful. And now we call upon Comrade Walter Sisulu to address this great assembly. And Sisulu goes to the microphone and he says, keep Johannesburg tidy. And he was actually making a very important point. We're not fighting the revolution now. We're in power. We don't want big grand slogans. We don't want epic. We want people to work well, to look after the details, to be proud of your city. It was a kind of a funny and telling moment, and that's all brought to mind by seeing all the litter everywhere. It could have been towards the end of the day. If I'm a real scientist, I can tell from the way the shadow falls, but I can't, what time of day it is. And it looks to me as though this is an area where people come and put up their stalls. But these are such makeshift stalls. You know, look at it. Everything is makeshift.
Thank you. I'm going to jump ahead a tiny bit. This is one of my favorite photos. I, just from a photography standpoint, I'm not sure that it will bring anything to mind, but it's a photo out the back of a car of a Toyota covered pickup where it says Peace in Soweto on it. And it's just, I think, a gorgeous photo. And just to think about Soweto and to think about the concept of peace in Soweto in 94 just, I feel, is very poignant.
Part of the story of our transition that's almost left out, and we're trying to correct that, is the road of the peace accords. And they were established in, I think, late 1990. So Mandela's released in February 1990. Talks about talks. We'd had talks about talks about talks to get Mandela released, the ANC unbanned. Then the unbanned ANC is now talking to the government about talks. And a decision's taken to have peace accords to involve communities in the whole process. And that was done to prevent little fires getting out of hand, some kind of a clash. There's still a lot of tension. There are lots of rogue white racist, ultra-racist groups armed. There could be people from the African community angry, bitter, It could be somebody just drunk, fighting a policeman, killing a policeman, the police fire back, and the next thing you've got. So it was felt very valuable to have something countrywide, not only in Soweto, throughout the country. And faith communities played a very big role, community organizations. And people, we're now gathering that evidence to put it in the museum and archive of the Constitution and the Constitution-making process. And some of these pictures might be very valuable for our project. So people from the Black African townships, from the colored townships, from the areas reserved for Indian community, would meet whites. Whites weren't in townships. They had the rest of the city. They'd never met before as equals on anything. And the stories are generally very heartwarming, a kind of an eagerness just to keep the peace. And people would speak with their different body language, different accents, their clothing would be different, their styles. But it was like white South Africa was now meeting with black South Africa meeting with white South Africa on the basis of shared tasks to protect the negotiation process. So the symbol then would have been, I think, the symbol of the peace accord. It's a kind of variant of the same as Picasso, Love of Peace. It's very lovely for me to see it. Toyota gets a space as big as Peace Soweto. They might even have lent cars, business coming on board to help the process.
Thank you. I quite like these next two as well. This is more showing daily life in the townships, perhaps in Soweto. It's kind of hard for me to tell. And this is a photo of a woman selling some foodstuffs at a makeshift stall.
I kind of sigh. In the background, there's a trolley that would have been taken from one of the supermarkets. And what she's selling, is it potatoes? Some vegetables? Not quite clear what are in the bottles, those plastic bottles. And it's such small stuff, and she would make, I don't know, she's lucky, a couple of dollars in the day. But people are poor, poor, poor. Soweto is one of the, in general terms, one of the big success stories in South Africa. The roads are tarred. There are far fewer shacks than there used to be before. And if you regard getting shopping malls and as a sign of progress, there's been visual, physical development. People will shop there instead of the long trek into town. They've got a community art center. You can see movies there which you couldn't before. There's swimming pools that function. So my guess is you wouldn't see many very, very poor selling to the even poorer, like you see in this picture now, in Soweto. But you'd see it elsewhere in the country, many, many places.
This photo, I think, makes it even more stark. This is two small children in the foreground, and in the background is a township, and you can just see the construction on the houses, how poor it is. And it's true that Soweto today looks completely different.
Yeah. But what I like about this picture is these kids have got energy, expressivity, a vitality that's not crushed by the poverty. And then you look at the houses in the background, and there's a kind of certain orderliness to the spaces they occupy. there are big debates now about the whole government program on housing was to tear down these shanties, these self-constructed. They were dangerous because of fires. There was no clean water, no proper sewage. They didn't have electricity. And replace them with not wonderful housing, but solidly constructed cement brick homes with electricity, with water, with sewage laid on, which people could feel are their homes, and they could get title to it in due course. And something like 3.5 million homes have been given free. So if there's an average of 4 people moving into each home, that's maybe 14 million people out of a population of 50-odd. So it's more than a quarter of the total population have moved from homes like this into brick homes with water, electricity, sewage, usually 2.5, 3 rooms. And by international standard, that's spectacular. But the heavy criticisms that, first of all, they're just homes. They're often far away from work, where land was cheap. So a huge amount of time is spent traveling and a huge amount of income. And traveling becomes dangerous because they can be attacked. They're not communities. They're just rows and rows and rows of homes without schools, sports fields, churches, whatever people want, cinemas, swimming pools, gardens, play areas. So now there's a strong push towards, instead of moving people out of homes like these, to give people spaces to rebuild on the areas where they live, and facilities to build, but to build upwards, not long sprawling suburbs that use up a lot of land that could be better used for agriculture and that invariably are far from places of work. Very, very important, hard debates going on right now. And yet, you know, so many millions moved into the new homes, millions more constructed. They came from rural areas. Instead of staying with the family, people wanted their own homes. So it's not as though it's got rid of the informal settlements. They're probably as big in number as they were before. But what is definitely different is there are millions of people now living in conditions that are not wonderful, not even good, but miles, miles, miles better than they were before.
I'm going to move us a little further because I have some questions about some specific things, although this is one that I do particularly like while I look for the set in Johannesburg. I believe that is a train car or a bus? It looks like a train car to me that they're hanging out of. There are several young men hanging out of the window of a train car.
Yeah, you know, it's. I see like 3 or 4 different stories there. The sense I get is a kind of bravado on their part. And during the struggle days, we had a magazine, a critical progressive magazine, was called Staff Rider. And a staff rider was somebody who would avoid the ticket collectors on the train by hanging outside. I don't know if you have an American term for it's not like a stowaway. A stowaway stays hidden. The staff rider hangs on outside. It's so dangerous. It's kind of daring. It's crazy. But you don't pay. And that was a mixture of poverty and bravado and defiance. But it's also the, you know, this train I don't think is full inside. So it's not as though they're compelled to sit out like that. And but often the trains are heavily overcrowded, jam-packed, not well managed, the car culture has hit South Africa very hard. The middle class, upper middle class, you get your motor car, and they're influential in all parties, including the ANC. And so the emphasis on public transport has been far below what it ought to be. And so the poor have to get to work. As long as they get from point A to point B, mission accomplished. But we had a case in our court, in fact, brought by railway commuters in Cape Town, complaining that there was no protection on the trains. So the thieves would get on board with their knives, threaten the passengers can't get off, and there was nobody who could be called to assist the passengers. And the Railway Commuters Organization said this was a violation of their fundamental rights. It came to our court, and we extended the law to say that the railway authorities were under a duty. They were saying it's the police. The police are saying, no, we don't have control over what's happening on the stations and in the carriages. So each was pointing a finger at the other. What had happened was the very last years of apartheid stretched. So they took the railway police away from the railways and they made them guard the frontiers of South Africa. They never came back. And our court declared that the railway transfer authorities had a legal duty to provide at least physical protection that they couldn't say this is a police matter, our job is just to transfer from point A to point B. So all of this is brought home by this picture. I don't know what crooks look like. They don't look like crooks to me. Mm-hmm. But I don't think crooks have a particular dress code. I think the train is stationary at the moment the picture is taken. But it's indicative in an almost comic way of a reality that's not comic at all.
This is a photo that it starts a series of photographs that I have some questions of, but I don't think that it actually goes with what's in Johannesburg, the scenes, but I might be wrong. I'm not quite sure. Is a very large crowd of people, some of whom are sitting along a wall somewhere.
Yes, now my first thought is that this is an Inkatha Freedom Party battalion group. As far as I can see, it's all men, and they would be migrant Zulu-speaking workers living in hostels in Johannesburg, in Durban, all over what was then the Witwatersrand, and they're carrying their cultural weapons, as it was called, in this case, sticks and shields. There was a lot of tension between them and the ANC. Their leader, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, was alleged to work closely with Pretoria, that his clandestine units got military training from South African right-wing securocrats, and they would use their hostels to march in the streets with what they called cultural weapons, but that included pangas, assegais, spears, which you don't see in this picture, and commit mayhem, terrorizing communities. This 1994, at the time of elections, the Carter Freedom Party, at the last minute, came into the elections. We had to put stick on two batches of election materials, voting slips. So it was 22 million national elections and another 22 million provincial elections. Pictures of Buthelezi just a couple of days before the elections had to be stuck on at the bottom because it was really a kind of eyeball-to-eyeball contest to get him on board, to come on board at all. So this would have been, I suspect, at a time when the Inkatha Freedom Party are contesting the elections. They've been called upon to vote. They're not being called upon to massacre ANC people. Now I'm reading all of that into the picture.
Sure, that's all right. I'm also curious, keeping in line with sort of electoral opposition to the ANC, I think that there's a historical perception that the ANC was guaranteed to win. And I think that that is true to an extent, but that doesn't mean that there was an opposition.
You know, in retrospect, it seems guaranteed. In 1989, I came up, we were still in exile, with the phrase, all revolutions are impossible until they happen, then they become inevitable. South Africa is now between the impossible and the inevitable. We have to start planning for a new constitution. So at the time, people were doing their speculations, and they reckoned, okay, the whites will vote as a bloc, small number for ANC, bigger number for the Democratic Party, but not a huge amount, but overwhelmingly for the National Party. The calculations were the colored people overwhelmingly for the National Party, Indian people maybe more for ANC. And in the rural areas, the traditional leaders, many of them were supporting the Afrikaner Nationalist government, the traditional leaders. And so they reckon maybe if they get 20 or 30% of the black vote, put it all together, they could even get a majority. And it turned out in the rural areas, the traditional leaders didn't have that sway at all when it came to voting. The colored people, there was a much bigger vote then for the ANC than turned out to be afterwards. And the Carter Freedom Party secured a majority in the counted votes in one province, KwaZulu-Natal. But there's a very good book on the subject by Peter Harris to show, in fact, they didn't win. But the ANC were more concerned for the elections to be declared free and fair, the new parliament to start, than to have any trouble contesting those elections. But there was real ballot stuffing, of ballot box stuffing by IFP. I think in some cases more than 100% votes for a particular candidate. So they didn't truly win in KwaZulu-Natal, but ANC decided strategically better accept those fraudulent results, and Mandela becomes president. We can start dealing with that province, and lo and behold, within a couple of elections, ANC were the majority party there.
It makes me
Buthelezi, by the way, he's about 90 now. He can't let go. People are commenting on that. And the party was very much around his personality, what was called a well-educated person, been to Fort Hare. His mother was a very wonderful princess, a singer, had a beautiful voice, and she sang poems and songs about the Zulu nation. And he was at one stage an ANC supporter and belonged to the black intelligentsia that supported the freedom struggle. But then the story is he was cultivated by Pretoria. He had ambitions and was responsible for many terrible things that happened in terms of people whom he armed and saying, I'm against violence. But the violence came from his own groups. And now he was in the government of national unity after 94. There was a time when both Mandela and Thabo Mbeki were out of the country, and there was no way that de Klerk was going to be asked to be a stand-in president. It might have been after he'd actually pulled out of the government of national unity. So Buthelezi was made temporary president of South Africa. And I feel that's a very African thing, and maybe a very thoughtful ANC thing, that for 3 days or 4 days, you know, he's given this little kind of gift because it meant so much to him. If that saved lives, then it was worth doing. So now there's kind of huge ambivalence about him. I'd say in general terms, he's unpopular amongst young people, unpopular amongst old stalwarts of the struggle. But he's recognized as part of the scene, one of the threads of our history.
Another way that you see sort of opposition in these photographs are through political signs that are not just for the ANC, but this sign is for the Democratic Party, for the DP, on the streets of Johannesburg. And the sign says, no killers, kidnappers, torturers, or corrupt politicians.
Democratic Party, and then in Afrikaans as well. Mm-hmm. And this would have been in Johannesburg, and they're Johannesburg-type buildings. So if it's in Afrikaans in Johannesburg, it's not aimed at the colored community. It's aimed at white Afrikaans speakers. Mm-hmm. And it's very much rally around the whites, defending the whites. I'm not sure what would have triggered that. But it's a very aggressive kind of slogan to have. Compare it to Better Life for All.
I thought so as well. This photo also foreshadows some violence that are in these photos. There are a number of photos that show various things happening. I don't know if they'll make more sense in tandem or individually. I'm wondering now if the photos of the African National Party are more connected to this than I thought, because I see the shield again in this photo.
Yes, the shield is very likely to be Inkatha. And very ragged clothing. It could be, you know, the hostel dwellers. But that would be, yeah.
These photos continue there. Photos of people lying on the pavement, including photos of bodies covered by a body bag or by blankets.
You know, there was a march by Inkatha on the ANC offices, and it's from the city hall to the office elsewhere downtown. And they were threatening to storm the offices, and people opened fire from inside, and some of the Inkatha people were killed on the spot. It was a very shocking incident. You can get the date. It was very well covered, and this looks to me, because one of the pictures shows somebody armed with a gun. Who could have been ANC self-defense.
There are a few photos later where it shows what appear to be white police officers, but also black individuals with guns shooting.
Yes.
Including this one photo of what appears to be a white police officer, though he's not in uniform, that I just think is very striking.
Yes, now that seems to be outside a police station. Those lamps would be the police station lamp.
But I wonder if...
There's no way of knowing if they were in a sequence?
Oh, there is. So these are in a sort of sequence that the photographer took the photos.
I mean, yeah.
And they can also be looked at in their storyboard with the other photos that weren't printed,
yes,
which may tell more of the story for a researcher someday. But thinking that it might be an Inkatha march on City Hall does help put the pieces together.
You know, this guy doesn't look like somebody supporting the ANC self-defense unit at all. So he could have been accompanying the Inkatha. And there were shots fired from the Inkatha group down in the street.
I believe this is a different event that starts next.
Yes, okay, this is interesting. It's a separate thing completely.
It is. But, yeah, I was very struck by the violence of these photographs, by the photographer's presence at such a violent event.
And was this Freed himself?
Yes, Freed himself took all of these photographs. And he passed away several years ago now, so it would be impossible to
ask. Okay, the stuff was well written up. A lot of it was captured on film. And there were definitely shots from the ground up into the Trulli House, it's now called. Then it was called Shell House, the ANC headquarters. So the ones from the ground would have been Inkatha and their supporters. And the ones from the top down into the crowd could have been ANC self-defense unit. But the people who were killed were the marchers.
And here...
Yes, this is the one that puzzles me the most. Who that guy was, the one with the rifle on the ground, crouching.
Sure, there's a man in camo on the ground with a rifle crouching. This man here, he's in some sort of camouflage. In some sort of camouflage,
a more
military-looking uniform.
Yes, so I don't know if he would have been South African military. I don't know if Mkhwanazi's were in those days, had uniforms, but you'll be able to get material.
Sure.
It was filmed.
And you can see here there's a picture of an ambulance that says Johannesburg on it and a medic working on one of the individuals who was shot.
Oh, okay.
So it's just a very interesting series. Thank you for that direction to go in with Inkatha. And then the tone changes completely in the next event that was photographed.
So this is Roodepoort. It will probably have an African name now. It's to the south, southeast, I think, of Johannesburg. And the demand is Ace No Volksstaat Gebied. Demand now a People's State Volksstaat Gebied territory. And that was the extreme right wing of the white Afrikaans-speaking community, wanted their own Afrikaner homeland. And there's a little bit in the Constitution to this day that theoretically allows for the possibility of a white Afrikaner homeland. And Mandela explained to us on the National Executive of the ANC very short while before the elections of this proposal to put in an amendment into the Constitution that would allow for the theoretical possibility of ethnic homelands in South Africa. And he said, this sounds very, very odd. We in the ANC have been fighting all our lives against Bantustan's ethnicizing the state, the society. Why are we proposing that this go in? And he said in 1982, on the 20th anniversary of his imprisonment, he called together the leaders of the ANC in prison, and he said, comrades, I think the time has come, we must take an initiative about negotiations. And they said, no, comrade Madiba, the time isn't ripe. And he said, when is the time ripe? After 20 years. And they said, no, we must leave it to Lusaka, that they're in charge. So after that little group disbanded, Sisulu came up to him and said, Madiba, I can see you're very keen on this. I voted against it, but go ahead and do it. You want to do it. If it succeeds, we'll all be happy, and if it doesn't, we will disavow you. So this is Mandela telling us this. He said that was 1982. It's now 1993 or 1994, and not only are we having elections under a new democratic constitution, but the people who were locking us up are now taking part in the elections. And they're taking part in the elections not because they were defeated in battle, but because they see it's the only way forward for South Africa. And that's much more valuable than fighting till you conquer them, and then they have to submit, and then they're waiting to fight back afterwards. So in the case of the right-wing Afrikaners, they say, we're not against democracy for South Africa, but we want our own homeland somewhere. And if we sign on to the Constitution as it stands, we're forever in principle giving up our rights. So they want at least the theoretical possibility of one day having an Afrikaner homeland. And he said, we are willing to agree to that, subject to two conditions, that if they do have such a homeland where there's a majority of people of a certain ethnicity who want it, it must be a non-racial country. And secondly, it must be the South African Parliament that will decide its borders where it should be. And he said, if they have that, they'll take part in the elections and we can avoid who knows what. And we knew what he was getting at because they had the guns. They had 20,000 white men inside the army, 20,000 on reserve, armed, disciplined, structured, waiting for the command from the leader of that group, General Constant Viljoen, or former General Constant Viljoen. And they will now come into the elections. And he said they'll find out themselves it's impossible. But if they find it out themselves, it's better than if they feel they've been denied that possibility, and then they fight. And it was exceptionally thoughtful and wise. It wasn't just Mandela. He had the whole team working on it. But the net result is there's this very incongruous clause in the Constitution that allows for the theoretical possibility of, they call it a false start. And people who were working with the team dealing with it said the representatives of that group, they were asked to draw maps where it could possibly be. And they couldn't find a map anywhere. And they would draw a map with a long finger coming down to their farm so that they could feel, you know, that we're going to be part of it. So in that sense, this picture, you see them all sitting down. The speaker, I can't recognize him, but I don't know that crowd all that well. Smartly dressed. The others, quite a few, even sitting on the ground wearing ties, but in those days it was fairly common. And it's one of, I would say, one of the victories of our process that people like these came into the negotiations and were willing to go to the ballot box, and they're still represented in Parliament. They get 1%, a little bit more than 1% of the national vote, but it gives them some representation in Parliament, and they're part of the larger project, and in that sense they're part of the nation, and they're not waiting for some kind of coup or attempt to seize power. They're not planning sabotage to destroy democracy.
Sure, everyone is at the table. So it works.
Yes, more than at the table and then accepting the result.
There are also a few photos. One is on the wall outside of your classroom right now. And another is being scanned, but of Mandela speaking as well.
Now, the most interesting thing for me in this photograph is Mandela's wearing a dark suit. He really didn't like wearing suits. He loved wearing a Mandela shirt, mm-hmm. very neatly tailored presidential shirt. I've got a big collection. I wear them instead of suits. He didn't even like the comfortable ANC casual wear. He was encouraged, I think, to wear tracksuits by Stan Greenberg and others. And that wasn't his style. But a dark suit, very rare. But there was one famous occasion in Cape Town. You know, we've continued a divided capital with the executive, the presidency in Pretoria, and the legislature in Cape Town. That was the deal done when the British gave independence to white South Africa. To get the Cape Colony in and to get the northern provinces, the old Boer republics in. So one day Mandela flew down to Cape Town from the presidential headquarters in Joburg, slipped over in Cape Town and discovered he was going to wear a dark suit for Parliament, and he only had brown shoes. And in those days, I've noticed recently, 2018, men wear brown shoes quite a lot, sometimes even noticeably vividly brown with dark suits. But then it was definitely not on. So he decided, he walked from the presidential homestead in Rondebosch to a shoe shop that was nearby. To buy some black shoes. And the owner of the shop was so astonished. There's the president trying on, you know, sitting down on the little stool, trying on the shoes. He phoned the press. He obviously got some good publicity. And Mandela wasn't averse to being seen as an ordinary person doing ordinary things. So that story became like a headline. Mandela buys shoes like any other person, and it wasn't staged, you know. It was the owner. Anyway, to seeing him in this dark suit that reminds me of that occasion. You can date it a little bit by the amount of grey in his hair. Of course, these are all 94.
Yes. Now we're...
So if one wants to date a picture of Mandela, you don't have a date. You can look at the amount of gray he had in his hair in 94, because you know it's 94 when these pictures were taken.
Sure. They say that when you become president, you age very much in the presidency, and they will put the different photographs of the president before and after. But, of course, Mandela had already been through lifetimes of things that age you at that point.
Yes, but there was still some black in his hair then. And then, of course, Obama aged quite a lot. And I've noticed even Trump, he's still got his fake hair. It's about fake news. His fake news right on top of his head. But some pictures of him in electioneering mode, he looked so much younger than he looks now.
Here are actual very young people. These are all at a campaign rally of some kind, but the boys are very young.
Yes, I mean, the youngsters here wouldn't have even had the vote, but they would definitely look as though they're on the campaign trail by giving the ANC salute. There was an organization called the Young Lions. That was the children of ANC people. When my kids visited me when I was in Mozambique, they joined the ANC Young Lions in Mozambique, and they learned to do the gumboots dance. They even taught me to do the gumboots dance, and they would recite the Freedom Charter, and it was quite good. But then, just before the elections, the Young Lions would be challenged by youth groups from Azapu, and they had guns. Became very ugly, very, very, very terrible. I remember in 1990, I visited Port Elizabeth for the first time. Now it would be in definitely more than 30 years. And they're very excited, the exiles coming back, and advocate Professor L.B. Sachs is here. And I was in the news quite a lot, particularly after the bomb. You know, it became something of quite a story. And they have a meeting. It's at the Feather Market Hall. And Port Elizabeth was the port for Oudtshoorn, where the ostriches were cultivated, looked after, and the feathers for all over the bourgeois women all over the world came from there. So the main hall in Port Elizabeth is called the Feather Market Hall, and I'm up on the stage, and people are cheering and singing songs, and I see it's a young black child standing behind me with a carved out sort of wooden gun, an AK, and I can't stand it. And I don't know what to do. And they're so proud. It's showing their militancy. And our youngsters are growing up in the struggle, and I can't bear it. And I don't know what to say. I kind of made a bit of a joke. I said, I feel very uncomfortable when there's a gun behind my back. Can that young boy please put his gun down? And that was my way of responding to the idea of militarizing children. And it was serious in those days, because it moved from just symbolical things of young people willing to fight for freedom in an abstract way and release Nelson Mandela, real live guns would be used. And the regime with their third force activities was provoking that, to get young people from Inkatha to fight young arms of the ANC. And then in the East Rand, as it was called, it was ZAPU youth fighting ANC youth.
I'm struck looking at this photo and thinking that in 1994, how old these boys were and how old they are now. I imagine that most of them are in their mid-30s to mid-40s, so they could, you know, how it shaped them growing up during this time and thinking about militancy and the ANC youth wing and just what where they all ended up, I guess, in this story.
Yeah, my guess is in some senses very confused, because many of them would have had opportunities their parents never had. Quite a few would have gone to high school, university. Some might be employed in government, earning quite decent amounts. But the fire, the passion, the enthusiasm went, and there's a younger generation called the Born Frees, born after 94, who never knew apartheid. Even these kids, you know, from 90 onwards, in 1990 they might have been very young, wouldn't have felt the heavy weight of apartheid. But the Born Frees after 94 didn't know it at all. I spoke at an event at the Market Theatre in Johannesburg last year. It was a young, very, very brilliant young black playwright spoke before me, and he said, "What's this thing apartheid? What was so special about apartheid?" And I almost collapsed. And part of me felt jubilant. They don't even know. It's a huge success we've had, that generation has no idea of how heavy, how pervasive it was, how, in that sense, astonishing and wonderful our struggle was in terms of its outcome, in terms of what it achieved, and getting a viable country. And then I said, when the shackles fall, the pinpricks hurt. So all the daily examples of white overlordship, which is still so strong in South Africa in all sorts of ways, cultural attitudes, economic positions, just kind of social comfort, become unbearable. Now this generation would have been between the two, and that's why I say it was also a time when the ANC Youth League was viciously corrupted by some white businessmen pretending to be sympathetic to the cause and capturing so easily a meal, a pair of shoes, some funding for study, and the next thing they're kind of in their pocket. So it demoralized that whole generation, and not many have emerged as genuine leaders who we used to say picking up the spears. I don't like the image of the spear so much, but carrying on the tradition. You know, that was the tradition in the Zulu militarized community. When somebody in the front row is killed, you pick up the spear, you carry on. So we use that phrase all the way through the struggle. You know, comrade, you must pick up the spear, carry on the struggle. And that's a noble kind of idea. Now we want to move away from the military imagery and symbolism. But the equivalent kind of got lost. And then when our leaders became manifestly corrupt, I can imagine their confusion. And now, as I'm talking, it's the beginning of 2019, there's much more confidence in the top leadership, Cyril Ramaphosa. I'd like to think this generation are thrilled that it's returning to the spirit and the values that inspired them so much, you know, when they were kids. But I couldn't say that for sure.
I'm actually going
to... thing on the youth at that time. Mandela's criticized by a number of young black people for giving away too much to the whites at the time of the Democratic Constitution came in. And not only does it wipe out 6 years of hard, bitter, relentless struggle, thoughtful struggle, inside the negotiating chamber and out in the streets, it completely misconceives how the Constitution was made. It wasn't a deal between Mandela and the government and a few business people. It came different stages over a long period of time. And Mandela's role was very, very small in the actual formulation of any of the texts. He was a wonderful public face who expressed in an exceptionally eloquent, elegant, thoughtful, humane way what we stood for. But he wasn't the person who drafted anything or laid down the basic lines of the Constitution. And there was only one issue that he was very insistent on, and that is that young people should have the vote, that these kids should have the vote. And he said, 15, 16, 17, and we on the Constitutional Committee said, no, Comrade President, 18 is internationally accepted, and it looks as though the ANC is so desperate for votes that it's getting school kids to the polls. And three times I was sent by the Constitutional Committee to speak to Mandela, and on the last occasion, he insisted young people should have the vote, and somebody did some research, and it turned out, I think there were five countries in the world where 15, 16, 17-year-olds could vote, and we asked, where are they? And it was North Korea, it was Yemen, and three other countries like that, and it would have been, and the ANC. And at that last meeting, the Constitutional Committee gave me a very firm mandate: we can't agree. And he was angry. He's patrician. He doesn't enjoy being, you know, he wasn't asking for something for himself. But he said, the young people fought so hard, they sacrificed so much, the time of Soweto. And then we said, but Comrade President, Soweto is 1976. It's now almost 20 years later. They're not kids anymore. But he insisted. And nobody knows quite why. 10 years later, he told that story against himself, how a president could be wrong. He was wrong. And he told it when he was trying to nudge Thabo Mbeki away from his terrible position on HIV/AIDS. So anyway, that's the stream of consciousness that flows from looking at that picture.
In this set of photographs here, we have a very large meeting, and there are various photographs of it. I'm not quite sure where the meeting is taking place, but it's of a Zionist church meeting. We can tell that they're Zionist because of the star that they have, and in some of the photos they're also holding a publication that's an African Zionist publication.
Yes, it's I grew up in Cape Town, which was very far away from the African Zionists, but anybody in Johannesburg, which was like my second city, would know. It was an independent African church that had broken away from the missions, from the Anglican church, not Catholic, not Dutch Reformed church, and had a strong African quality and not related to any international faith community. And very popular in what was then the old Transvaal in particular. And they would meet at a place called Moria, which would be maybe 200, 300 miles north of Johannesburg. And the members were identified by having, is it a silver star and a black with a bit of green?
Mm-hmm.
And the claim was that if you're an African Zionist, then it didn't relate to Israel at all. Zion was the promised land. I think you didn't smoke, you didn't drink. And what went with that was, and you'd be a good servant. So you're more likely to get a job. And you got the job because you're an African Zionist. Because the employers felt you likely to get a loyal, more submissive kind of employee. They would get up to 1 million people attending over Easter in the Moria area. It's a rural area. I can't identify the locality. I know it's a hilly area. There would have been lots of buses bringing people there.
There certainly are hills in some of these photos.
Yeah. So this could be at the Easter gathering.
Okay.
And Easter would be, what, in April? And the elections were in April, 27th of April. So it could have been for a visiting photographer, something easy to... To combine. My son Michael, who became the director of the South African budget, is married to Ghadi, G-A-D-I, whose parents are African Zionists from that particular area. So at their wedding, there was no liquor. It was actually a very extraordinary occasion with maybe 100, 200, 300, mainly African women, rural, and about 20 or 30 youngish white lefties with outrageous costumes, spiky ginger hair and funny leggings and so on. And they mingled. Them, obviously, you know, it was a very, very joyous, very special occasion. But I don't discuss religion with Michael's in-laws. But we get on, you know, very, very nicely.
It makes me think about how South Africa is so diverse. It's racially diverse, but also
yes.
Just beyond that, it's diverse in so many other ways. There are some hills
yes,
here.
Let me look at...
Sure.
Yes. It's popular. It's working class. It's rural. The African middle class is more likely to belong to the Anglican Church or the Catholics, Presbyterian congregational. There are many Christian churches, some even to the Dutch Reformed Church, and this has a in everything they do is less derived from the established missionary introduced Christianity with a whole set of hymns. The Methodists have their hymns and the Anglicans have their hymns and the Zionists have, it's not only independent in terms of their theology, but a popular community-oriented style and set of connections. And in an interview from another box I mentioned, but it might be worth repeating now, in 94, it would have been, you can work it out, but Easter, I think, would have been before April the 27th. With 1 million people camped out there, the political leaders were very eager to at least be seen and to make sure that the other top leaders didn't dominate. So Mandela was there, de Klerk was there, and Buthelezi was there. They weren't given speaking roles, but they were given very prominent seated positions, and you can get that. And people were joking that it must have been especially punishing for de Klerk, because he was a chain smoker, and no smoking was allowed. He couldn't even go around to the back for a quick puff. So it must have been, and it's long, and the speeches went on forever, and the singing went on forever, and the praying went on forever. It must have been an agony for him. And I don't think it won him any extra votes, so they would have cancelled each other out for being there.
I'm remembering, as you're speaking, that one of the photos that's on display right now has the name of, you said it's Moriah? Is that how you say the name of the place? Where they would
Maria.
Gather Maria.
Yeah.
Restaurant is one of the photos I had totally forgotten, and I wasn't sure if that meant anything. So I'm sure that this is the Easter gathering that you speak of.
And my guess is it's not a posh restaurant that many leaders today would go to, you know, ordering expensive.
This is another angle of the building. So this building, when the sign continues on, says that.
Okay. Yes, well, seeing the hills in the background, it was such a big crowd. You need people seated on the slope.
There are a number of photos of this group, many, many of them, including at some points people carrying luggage because they obviously stayed for a while. Long lines of men.
Yeah.
And the food. There's a woman carrying food on her head in this photograph, and I think of what it must have been to feed that many people coming for Easter. It's an incredible undertaking and organization.
Yes, I mean, one of the nice things about these photos, normally the photos are of the leaders at the at the rostrum, and these pictures capture the congregants at a moment not when they're being addressed.
I'm seeing what I think is interesting is I don't think that there are any photos in here, unless I'm not remembering correctly, of the leaders.
Some of them in prayer?
Yeah, this is a photo of them in prayer. A group of men. And the crowds in some of these photos are just incredible. It's just a sea of people. And a few that are quite fun, like this child. There's a child hanging off of the tree, yes, smiling.
The first smile I've seen, actually.
Yes, they're very, very somber.
Very somber.
And then it finishes without any photos of the leaders, but there are a couple more photos. Actually, I'll have to dig them out, of some other collections. And this, I think, is an interesting rally, because I don't know if you'll notice without me telling you where this is. I have two smaller prints of a rally in New York City when Mandela came to New York. I know, when I first saw them as well, I said, where is this?
Yes, yes. Yes, the portrait didn't look like one of our kind of portraits. So I thought it could be downtown Johannesburg somewhere.
So this is the same photographer, but 4 years earlier. This is in 1990. So this is right after Mandela is released from prison, and he sort of goes on a world tour. And he visited many places in the United States, including New York.
And a ticker tape.
And there's a young boy with a Free South Africa sign with ticker tape all over him. And there's a whole series of photographs that we don't have here in our special collections yet. But they're by Leonard Fried as well. So he saw Mandela 4 years before he went to South Africa. And there are some photos of some other things as well that I have here that are not the same collection, including a series of photographs of this man who I'm sure you recognize.
I do. And he's kind of finally saying goodbye.
We're talking about Johnny Clegg.
Yeah. He did something in Paris last week, I think. I think he's not well.
No.
But his music has stood up exceptionally well.
He's incredible to see perform, too. I was lucky enough to see him in concert several years ago in Lusaka, and it was incredible. So this is the end of the collection that we have, and I'm just wondering if you have any further thoughts on just the collective of these photos or anything else that brings to mind.
For me, it's very heartwarming to see them. And I like the spirit of the pictures. They're not taken to shock or produce a quick kind of emotion. They're respectful. They're respectful of the people being photographed. And there's no sense of posing. There might be one or two see the camera and put on a big smile and a wave. And in that sense, it's a lovely evocation of that time. It's represented today as though it was a time of euphoria. And the euphoria came when the election results came out. Then there was absolute joy, you know, and dancing and celebration. But there was concern beforehand. And there had been some attempts to bomb some of the polling stations. Some people died in some areas. And nobody knew exactly how it would work out. And kind of delight that the elections went off peacefully. Very widespread. White people I knew were all buying up canned goods, stocking up. So I didn't buy anything that would last more than one day on purpose. And then I was stuck because the elections went on an extra day. And there'd been violence until fairly near the end. The country was raw. Nobody knew would the elections go off peacefully or not. They did, which was tremendous. The whites were still running everything. The transfers hadn't actually taken place. And the kind of slogan that one saw of the Democratic Party was really suggesting that a gang of thugs would be taking over, incompetent, could only manage by means of violence. And there were a lot of stories, many of them true stories, about things that didn't function well. Within a fairly short time, we learnt about the members of parliament on the gravy train getting expenses from parliament, things they actually didn't do. It was a constant kind of sniping. And it did anticipate what turned out to be real corruption, quite serious. But it wasn't like there was national euphoria and joy. And these pictures are not representing moments of victory, moments of triumph, anything like that at all. They're soft, gentle pictures of capturing very much members of the African community, and showing the diversity in the African community. And that African community is diverse not only in terms of language and so on, but its class formation, their different religious faiths that are quite significant in the country. And so a lot of stories come through in a very natural way. And then you need to know that there's a big Indian community and a big community, especially in the Cape, people from the colored community, and then the whites, in the sense the name indicates, are pretty bland comparatively in terms of a distinctiveness. Bland, I suppose, because their culture became the dominant culture, so it becomes almost like an official point of departure for everybody and everything. But lots of variance within the white community as well. And these pictures provide threads, very, very lovely threads, and taken by somebody, I would suspect, who had a gracious heart and a thoughtful eye, and who's not taking pictures to illustrate a point. The point is in the pictures, and then you can draw whatever stories you want from it. So I think it's obviously a very valuable collection because he's a famous photographer, and these are pictures not part of this ordinary realm. But I think that they have a quality, a timeedness, not timeliness, a timeedness that's very appreciable. And for me, very appreciated. So thank you for giving me the chance to look at them, to remember things, and to be connected with MSU.
Thank you so much for being here with us today. It's been wonderful.